Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Today's Football Times. This is a bit weird. I'm at the steering wheel, which is, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. What could possibly go wrong? Tonight, we have the three of us again, and it is the very familiar, Paul McParland. And we good evening, Paul. And we also, to give him his big introduction tonight, the wonderful Dave Bowler. Dave has taken us all on as a set of Luddites, as we are. He is our new technical guru. He tells us, you know, where to be and when, and he makes us sound all fantastic, which takes a bit of doing, to be fair. Dave has other side parts of his career. He is an author of a myriad of books, inclusive of biographies on Bill Shankly, Danny Blanchflower, and Sir Alf Ramsey. And he has also been heard and has piloted many a podcast elsewhere as well. Good evening, Dave.
Good evening. That's far too kind of build-up. I'll live down to it over the weeks.
Can we just ask Stephen that Dave is our Merlin? He's our technical wizard.
He is. I think guru, wizard. You know, anything applies here. You know, given that we are just utterly hopeless ourselves.
When it all goes wrong, it's all my fault.
We are all very reverential towards Dave.
Very kind.
Well, tonight, just as it has been with all of our episodes so far in this new run of Today's Football Times, it's just a round table, basically. We've all brought a topic, we've all brought something that we're looking forward to in the days, week, even beyond sometimes ahead. And kicking us off tonight, I think we'll go with Paul.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thanks for listening to us again, and hope you liked the last few episodes of the Today's Football Times, and I hope you like this one as well. Yeah, so I was going to kick off with a brief discussion on what I consider to be the most exciting league in Europe, after the Championship, because I was looking at the Championship table today, and I was quite dumbfounded to see that top of the table, Burnley, at a mere 7 points ahead of Cardiff in 17th position. Now, that is what you call a competitive league. I mean, by comparison, Arsenal are 24 points ahead of the 17th team in the Premier League. So it gives you some idea there of how competitive and how tight the Championship has been this season. I mean, it wasn't quite so last season because basically Fulham in particular and Bournemouth walked away with it. But this year, for some reason, it seems to be such an evenly matched division. And you look at some of the stats from the Championship this season. You've got Burnley, who are top. They played 14 games, but they've only won six of them. But because they have only lost one, that's kind of nailed on that top place for them. You've got teams like Blackburn, who've lost seven games, which is more than some teams in the bottom three. But because they haven't drawn any and they've won eight, they find themselves just outside the top three as well. And then you've got teams like Cardiff, who we mentioned before, who are 17th, who've lost less games than Blackburn, which is just totally bizarre. So it just seems to be, from one week to the next, you can never quite predict who's going to end up top of the table, who's going to win, who's going to lose. And whenever the team hits a run of form, they then seem to stumble. So a few weeks ago, it looked as though Sheffield United and Norwich were walking away with the league. But suddenly, they've been dropping points. Norwich lost the last two games. I think Sheffield United got 1 point for the last three games. So suddenly, they slipped down. Whereas like so Burnley have come up from just outside the promotion spot to find themselves at the top of the table. I was looking at Swansea City. About 5 weeks ago, they were just outside the bottom three. Suddenly, a few wins, and they find themselves now hovering just underneath the actual promotion places. So it's fascinating from start to finish. And I think as well, with the intensity of the current fixture scheduling, with the game every weekend, every midweek, it's just added to the general excitement that attaches itself to this level of football. And in terms of how seriously it is kind of taken as well, I mean, from the manager's perspective, 9 championship clubs have changed the manager this season. 7 have been sacked, 2 have left to go elsewhere. That's almost half of the division have changed managers in such a short space of time. So it just gives you some idea of the intensity and the pressure for success as well. And I think from my perspective, because I tried to get to a few, you know, Football League games if I can. I went to Wigan at the start of the season when they played Preston in Lancashire Derby. And what really strikes me are 2 things. One, the age profile at championship matches of the fans is definitely a younger demographic than what you get in the Premier League, because I don't think in the championship, younger fans are priced out to the same extent as what they are Premier League grounds. Secondly, it's easier to get a match day ticket for a championship club than what it is for any of the big clubs in the Premier League. You need to be on a season ticket, part of a members club, be on a waiting list, or buy an expensive hospitality package to get entry. So it's much more accessible to a large number of the population that way. Thirdly, I just think of the championship games, you get a higher proportion of local-based fans who are supporting their local team rather than being surrounded by football tourists who come along with the 50-50 scarves to film the game and send it back to their friends. I also think as well that the big thing that adds to the intensity and atmosphere of the championship is the away support, because as a percentage of the capacity of a stadium, the away support in the championship is far, far, far superior to what you get in the Premier League. So, for example, you know, I'm not quite sure the numbers today, Steve, but I guess Man City didn't have more than about 2,500 fans there today because of the restrictions that the Premier League imposes on away supporters. But those restrictions don't seem to exist in the championship. So I remember going to Wigan Athletic a few times last season, and the whole away end was just completely occupied by away supporters, and that just adds to the atmosphere. So for all sorts of reasons, to me, the championship is almost like what Division One was like in the 60s and 70s, when most teams start the season with an equal chance of promotion. It's not a two-horse race, it's competitive, and every game seems to have something hanging upon it. So from those kind of points of view there, I just think, with a bit more marketing, the championship could really pose itself as a real serious survival, as an alternative to the Premier League.
Oh, I get where you're coming from, Paul. I mean, I know with my own experiences going to places like Wigan and Blackburn was another one as well. I think a lot of the allocation you get for away games often depends on how many home tickets get sold. So, you know, we go to Blackburn and get 8,000 tickets. You know, you go somewhere else where, you know, a lot of home support, you know, there's a huge, you know, will for the home supporters to go to a game. You won't get quite as many. You know, you might be restricted to 800,000 or something like that. But, you know, I think it does. It always adds to the atmosphere. But that division's just absolutely, it's a proper demolition derby. You know, it's massively entertaining. You know, I'm looking at it now and it's kind of like Burnley top of the table. You know, they've only lost one game, but they're only a point ahead of Blackburn Rovers who have lost 7 times. This is because Burnley are drawing games at a rate of 7 out of, you know, half of the 14 games have been drawn. You know, that the 14-15 game stage here as well, this is kind of like one third of the way into the season, basically. And it's where the table should start to see schisms and little breakaways and just the dividing lines where the borders start to show themselves. But there's just no evidence of it so far. And you look at last season as well. Nottingham Forest, you know, started so badly, and look where they've gone. All right, you know, they're not doing particularly greatly at the minute, and the transfer, you know, merry-go-round is somewhat perpetuating. But I think Huddersfield were another one where they got to the playoff final, off the back of a really awful start. You know, I think it's just so wide open, and that's at both ends of the table. It never lets you down as far as division goes. What teams can do. I think what as well, it's also a division where if a team that's been well prepared and is brilliantly organised and tactically astute going from League One into the Championship, they can hit the floor running and go straight for promotion. I think it was a few years back, there were a spate of teams that seemed to do back-to-back promotions. Norwich did it under Lambus, and I think Wigan came very close to it as well. You know, that difference between the top end of League One and kind of like the Championships, very, very, you know, interchangeable. I think it's a division that gives proper hope. And I'm amazed. I'm still amazed that the Premier League themselves haven't looked at this and thought of forming a Premier League second tier, basically. You know, I think of all the changes that might come in the years to come, I could still see that being the case eventually, just because of just how much entertainment's in there and how many big clubs have mm-hmm. befallen down there as well. The, you know, will attract an audience and will attract the crowd. Dave, mm-hmm. your team's in there. Your team's in that mad mix this season. What's your take on it?
Well, I mean, not only is it was West Brom my team. I worked there for 19 years doing the programme, and about half of that was in the Championship and half of it was in the Premier League. I mean, I don't know. The Championship is the blood and guts league, really. It's I hate to use the term old-fashioned football, but it is to a large extent. The cliche, any team can beat any other, genuinely applies in the Championship. I mean, at West Brom, even when we had really strong promotion years, thinking back to Tony Mowbray's year when they came through and won the league, about six, seven games out from the finish, they lost 4-0 at home to Leicester, who went down to League One that year. You know, so it is that kind of league. I think there was a period probably 4, 5, 6 years ago when the Premier League money was distorting it a bit, and it was too easy a thing to come down from the Premier League and go straight back up. And obviously Albion did that quite a lot. One or two other teams did it quite a bit. I think that seems to have dribbled away a little bit. I mean, I would have expected Norwich and Watford to be in that group this year, but I think they've probably got a bit of yo-yo fatigue. I mean, they've done it too often now. I think there comes a point where that sort of snaps a bit. Burnley, I think, are still trying to find a post-Dyche identity. So, you know, maybe that'll come as the season wears on. But it's genuinely, I know this sounds stupid as a supporter, but when you get promoted from the Championship, you do feel a kind of sense of loss, because it's not as much fun in the Premier League, really. For a team, you know, like a West Brom, like a Norwich, like a Watford. Because the first couple of times you come up to the Premier League, it's good fun. You know, you haven't been to Anfield for a while. You haven't been to Goodison. You haven't been to Old Trafford. What, you know, whatever it is. And then after you've lost for the third or fourth time running, it kind of gets a bit wearing. Whereas in the Championship, you know, you do know that you are going to have a chance of winning games every week. Not necessarily you are going to win them, but every game that you go to, whoever you're playing, whether it's home or away, you feel like, well, yeah, we could do something today. It could be we could get a great result. And the number of times in the Championship you get stupid results, 4-3s and 5-4s and that kind of stuff. If you want your entertainment, the Championship is a much better place to be. The quality of football is another, you know, that's another story. But in terms of entertainment, it really is a bit of a throwback, I think.
I mean, Dave's just gone back to that. I mean, there was a game yesterday, Sheffield United against Blackpool. So the final score was 3-3. Sheffield United missed a penalty on the 90th minute. Four players were sent off during the game. That's good value for your money, isn't it? You don't get that sort of drama in the Premier League.
Yeah, you feel like you've got your 15 quid's worth there, don't you?
Oh, undoubtedly.
But, I mean, as part of that, I mean, that fee, I mean, West Brom have had a really poor start this season. You know, they've got rid of Steve Bruce. And Aidan's missing out tonight on the chance to eulogise over the brilliance of Steve Bruce. You know, what is the next few weeks for West Brom? You know, these are one of the great forks in the road, isn't it? It's kind of like they've made that switch. We spoke about a couple of weeks ago about the timing of getting rid of a manager and all of that. And sometimes it's a head scratching moment when they do it, and sometimes it makes complete sense. It's a big moment for West Brom. Which way is it going to go?
I think the problem the Albion have got, and this happens to teams that go down to the Championship and stay there for 2 or 3 years, it's a financial issue. There's Chinese ownership that doesn't seem particularly engaged in the club, shall we say. So that there's a lot of problems on the money side of it. But I think a lot depends on who they get as next manager. Do they see the next manager as I mean, the problem with the album is for years they've just been hanging on. You know, they've gone through the card. We've had Pulis, we've had Pardew, we've had Allardyce, we've had Bruce. You know, I mean, logically, Mark Hughes must be next. But do they go for somebody like that, who they think is a safe pair of hands and might be a fix for this season? I think that'd be the wrong thing to do. I think at some point you have to do what they did, you know, back in 1999, 2000, when they got Gary Megson. You know, it was a young manager, something to prove in a hurry. And I think that's the kind of thing that they need to do now, you know, and give it. But instead of giving him 25 games and then deciding, no, this hasn't worked, you've got to give somebody a chance now, I think. I think it's a rebuild job at West Brom. That said, as you said, you know, you look at Forest last year, relegation candidates at the back end of September and then promoted by the time you get to May. There's no reason why Albion couldn't do that again. And yet, I think they're only 10 points behind Burnley. It's not a huge amount, is it?
It's not. Nice. Yeah, sorry, go on, Paul.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Dave. I mean, do you think, looking back, West Brom got rid of Billich far too early?
I would have thought so. I mean, that season, you really couldn't see anything other than relegation, to be perfectly honest, if you're being brutally honest about it. And that being the case, well, what was the point of Sam Allardyce? I mean, I know he's got a fantastic record of keeping teams up and all of that, but I mean, I don't think anybody could have kept Albion up that year. And then you go down, well, then you're looking at a 2-3 year project, aren't you, for whoever the manager is. Sam Allardyce was, what, 60, 61 at that point. He's not going to do a year, 2 years in the Championship and then to try and stabilise a club in the Premier League. There was no long-term view in that. Where had they got, you know, had they got relegated as you would have expected, then Billich would have been as good a bet as anybody to bring them back up. You know, I mean, Watford have gambled on it now, so you know, I don't see why Albion shouldn't get it. The thing was, there was no great push from the fans to get rid of him, and that's a big thing, I think. You know, if the fans are still, however you're doing, if the fans have bought into who your manager is, that's half the battle, isn't it? You know. And there was no great push to get shot of him and have somebody else in. So I think you know, you look at the recent day history, and I think that was a mistake personally. Yeah,
I think as well the fact that the division it doesn't seem to it just doesn't, you know, allow kind of, I don't know, that I don't know, that team with a pedigree and a past, there's simply no. It's such an unforgiving league as well. So if West Brom were to get this one wrong, you know, at that end of the table, it's somewhere you just don't want to be. You can look at a club like Sunderland, who made that trip into the third tier, what, 5 or 6 years, I think they were down. You know, Leeds spent a good few years down there. You know, it's just such a, I don't know, it's such a division that just smacks of being on thin ice. Every club seems to be on thin ice. Like you say, it's, you know, 9-10 points, the difference of a swing there from one end of the table to the other at a third of the way through. You know, the way it's shaping up, I mean, it's a demolition derby of division, I think most years, but this year in particular just seems to be shaping up to be, you know, exceptionally, you know, tight at all ends.
I mean, yeah, you know, you're right about League One. You look at League One there, Sheffield Wednesday are there. Ipswich are there and have been there.
Sheffield Wednesday were a club that were knocking on the door of the Premier League just, what, 2, 3, 4 years ago.
It's a division where, if you do get it wrong, I think the hangover from it can last a long, long time.
It can. It certainly can. Well, moving on to our next topic, I'm going to go next, and it's I'm fresh off the back. The croaky voice might give it away, but I'm fresh off the back of a trip to Anfield today for a boisterous game between Liverpool and Manchester City. I watched with interest on social media the other day, and I don't even know who suggested it. It was something on the BBC or Sky or the way that they build these games up, and it was described as the biggest game in English football. Liverpool and Manchester City, and obviously this stirred emotions, you know, for a lot of football supporters who aren't supporters of Liverpool and Manchester City, and it was I get the take of it. For me, it's two dividing lines between when you could talk about this type of thing, is that you have a contemporary biggest game, It's the game with the biggest meaning at that point in time. And then you have the biggest game in terms of historical nature. So every nation has their El Clasico of some description, that goes back for centuries. You know, and no matter what condition the two clubs involved are, it's always one of the, if not the biggest game of the season. But yeah, this phenomenon that always has always fascinated me is how two teams that will peak at the same time will be thrown together in this nouveau riche kind of rivalry and be told that it's the biggest of that point in time. You know, for me, it's always one of those where, you know, it's a time that will move on. I mean, I remember as a kid first tuning into football as such, and the biggest rivalry Liverpool had at that point in time was Nottingham Forest. And it was undeniably the biggest game in the country at that point in time. But that was a time that soon passed. You know, eventually it became Liverpool-Everton. It became Liverpool-Arsenal. Then Liverpool dropped out of it, and it became, you know, Leeds-Manchester United suddenly became the biggest thing. You know, the biggest, you know, the biggest seat at the box office. Manchester United-Blackburn, you know, it became Manchester United-Newcastle. You know, along came Wenger, and suddenly everything was Manchester United. These are rivalries, and you know, so when it's being described as kind of like the biggest game in England, I get it, but yeah, I also get the antagonism towards it. What's your take, Paul?
Yeah, I'd agree 100% with everything you said there, Stephen. My perspective on this has always been that I think since the arrival of Sky, there's definitely more of an angle of pushing football for the TV audience rather than for the actual audience that goes to matches. So from the TV perspective, they want to build this up for people who never go inside a stadium, to build as the biggest game in England, to really, you know, attract more viewers, to attract a greater worldwide audience by giving games and creating a rivalry between teams that historically probably hasn't existed at all. And I think, I mean, I don't know about your perspective, Steve, but I would guess still when you go to a game at Anfield, the first two fixtures you look out for are Liverpool, Man United, Liverpool, Everton. I'm not sure you look for Liverpool, Man City, also matches as the first thing on your fixture.
I totally agree with that. You look towards your traditional, age old rivalries. You know, you get that fixture list as when is the derby? You know, I always look for the derby first. And then I look, you know, when are we playing Man United? And you know, beyond that, then you might think, oh, well, who else is relevant at this point in time? Or, you know, I think when it came to away games, when we used to be going everywhere, I'd always be looking out for kind of like, when are we playing the promoted teams, especially if it was a team who hadn't been back in the division for a long time, because you were looking forward to going to a specific stadium or something, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it's never, I mean, even when it was kind of like Benitez versus Mourinho and stuff like that, I was never kind of like looking up when the Chelsea game was, you know, before I was looking up when we were playing Everton and Man United.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of, you know, backs up what I was saying, Steve. That I think for the match going fan, you have a different perspective of what the traditional rivalries are, despite the hype and intensity that, I mean, the build up for this week for anyone who wasn't a Liverpool Man City fan, it's just been totally, totally over the top. It got to the extent where, you know, if I was getting the morning paper now, I'd skip the first 4 or 5 pages because I know it's all going to be about the Liverpool Man City game. Okay, I've got a passing interest in it, but it's not to be all. I'm more interested in my own team than reading about the Liverpool Man City encounters. I'm sure Dave has the same view about West Brom as well. He'd rather read about his own team than, you know, having it kind of rammed into you that this is the game you have to watch, this is the game you have to enjoy.
I'd throw into that as well that at the opposite end of the spectrum, certainly for match-going supporters, the last thing they want to hear about before going into a big game is that big game. I know from my perspective, I pay no attention of any of the build-up and try and forget about it until the day of the match itself. Because, you know, you're just going to have sleepless nights otherwise. You know, you're right. It's a television or it's a written narrative, you know, to get people to subscribe to whichever channel's showing that game or to sell that newspaper.
I think as well, I mean, I think there's an angle from Sky as well to try and downplay the traditional historical rivalries between teams and create these new audiences, these new teams for the growing global audience that maybe just have the historical understanding or perspective of what English football was like. I mean, you know, there's been like a trend in recent years in Sky to create these artificial titles with Derby. I mean, the other week they're reporting on Portsmouth against Plymouth and calling it the Dockyard Derby. Now, I've never heard that phrase in sort of my life before. Well, you know, things like is it the M42 Derby when Leicester played Coventry? All these strange terminologies have now been associated to games by Sky to try and build them up to be something. That they really are. So I'm like you, Steve. I mean, I'm sure you know they would be thinking along the same lines. There are traditional rivalries that are embedded in your DNA of the club, and there are these new rivalries created by the media. And for me, I always fall back to the traditional rivalries rather than the newly created media rivalries.
Yeah, a lot of these rivals, they are just of their moments. They're of their era. You know, there'll be a 3-year cycle where these two teams will be, you know, at each other, you know, for a few years, and then one or the other falls away, or both fall away, and you know the last week's chip paper, you know, and someone else comes along. Then what I would say is that, you know, these kind of like passing rivalries, they do still leave a little bit of an imprint, you know. Mm-hmm. So like when we've been reunited with Nottingham Forest, for instance, last season in the FA Cup, and we're going to play them next week in the league. That kind of like little tingle comes back from like way back when. You know, what about you? What about you, Dave? Is there any teams out there that, away from your regular spat with Wolves and maybe any of your other Midland rivals, are there any other peculiar little rivalries that still stir the emotions?
I think there's, going back to the dim and distant past, Leeds United was always one, and that's purely because of the famous Jeff Astle goal in 1971, I think it was.
It was, yeah.
And we stopped Leeds winning the league. Albion hadn't won away from home for 16 months. And I think we were 17th, 18th in the league. Leeds, obviously, were the great team in the country. And Albion somehow won at Leeds. Don Revie went berserk. He came storming onto the pitch with his travel rug under his arm. There were a lot of miners on the pitch. There were players swinging punches at him. It was everything that you want from a game of football. And every time we go back to Elland Road ever since, they haven't forgotten, I can tell you.
But these little kind of like moments, though, I find that the people who live those moments, who were there to see them and to live them, they still retain that kind of angst towards it. I mean, I've a mate of mine, Kyle Kopach, he really has great issue with Nottingham Forest. And he's maybe 4 or 5 years older than me. So I'm that little bit softer on Forest than he is. But yeah, he really takes exception to Forest in a way that I don't. Because to him, he'd have been a little bit more tuned into it at the time when I'd have been like 7 or 8, something like that. He'd have been in his early teens. So yeah, you know, it is strange how that kind of antagonism can kick in. Paul, what's your irrational rivalry?
Yeah, well, I think I mentioned this a while ago, Steve. For some reason, Everton always had this irrational rivalry with Luton Town that kind of started in the mid 80s. Obviously, our paths haven't crossed since then. But when there was a possibility this last season of Luton coming up by the playoffs, there was definitely amongst a certain generation of Blues the theme Luton are coming back, right? We've got a few scores to set with Luton Town from the mid 80s. You know, the way they deliberately had to go and have some players, fans, you know, in that time. So it's one of those kind of strange rivalries, everything against Luton Town. So I was actually quite disappointed Luton didn't come up, because it would have been great to have revived that historic rivalry, to be honest.
No, it is good when a team like that comes back, because we had it with Leeds. You know, yeah. Leeds Liverpool was a massive fixture in the 60s and the 70s, and you know, even kind of like early noughties when it was Houllier and O'Leary, there were some wild games. Then the 4-3 and you know, we won there in the cup, and you know, even when they first came back at the beginning of the 90s, you know, there was a mad 5-4 at Elland Road. I remember going to and stuff like that, and you know it does for the people who kind of like live those previous eras. It means kind of like a lot. But then you see like the younger supporters, and they're kind of like, well, this doesn't really kind of like mean anything to me. So yeah, it is. It always fascinates me, those little. I mean, just thinking off the top of my head now, I mean, it's what it's like Sunderland and Coventry, and that instance of the I don't know, should we say that the mutually beneficial draw between Coventry and Bristol City that kept them up and sent Sunderland down in 77. You know, if you ever get a Sunderland fan onto the topic of Coventry City and Bristol City, then oof, it's like putting a coin in the jukebox and it running all night. It is high entertainment. Just fascinating stuff. But moving on. Dave, what topic have you brought to the table for us tonight?
It hasn't been a great week in Europe for Scottish clubs, has it? It's a real anomaly, I think, the way that the Scottish teams perform in Europe. I mean, as with everything in Scotland, I think you have to draw a distinction between what Celtic and Rangers do and what the rest of the clubs do. For instance, Hearts, they've got back into Europe for the first time in a while. It's been 4 or 5 seasons, I think, since Hearts have been in Europe. So, you can kind of understand the situation that they've got. I mean, they've been beaten twice by Fiorentina in the last couple of weeks, 3-0 at home, 5-1 away. I don't think anybody would be wildly surprised by either of those results. But I think you look at Rangers, they got all the way to the Europa League final, took it all the way to penalties against Eintracht Frankfurt last season, and now... I mean, you look at the group stage. Okay, they were drawn with Liverpool, Napoli, and Ajax. I mean, it's not an encouraging group if you're Rangers, is it? Particularly, but the scale of the defeats that they've had have been remarkable. Really, I mean, 4-0 in Amsterdam, 3-0 at home to Napoli, 7-1 at home to Liverpool. That defeats that are so big that they don't really make any sense. You know, you would anticipate that they would do better than that. And that's the weird thing, I think, with some of the Scottish results this year. Dundee United, they lost 7-0 to AZ Alkmaar. If my team loses 5 or 6-0, I'd like to think, well, OK, at least we've had 3 blokes sent off and taken 8 bookings during the game. We've done something. We've been a bit belligerent about it. But it seems that there's an element where they slip away too easily to it. And I think for Rangers and Celtic, It's a case of trying to have your cake and eat it, you know. I think they are at a big disadvantage in Europe financially. I think, you know, a lot of the other European teams make a lot more money than they do because of the TV deals they've got and all that kind of stuff. And then when they come back to Scotland and they, you know, they beat Hibs 6-1 or whatever, they then say, well, it's got nothing to do with the fact that we've got more money than you have. So they're trying to argue both sides of the coin. But to me, it's very difficult to see how one of your two teams can get to a European final, and then the following season, it's a complete catastrophe. You know, you look at Motherwell going out to Sligo Rovers, as I say, Dundee United out to Alkmaar. It doesn't really make a great deal of sense somehow. You know, obviously, you'll have seen the Liverpool game, Stephen, the two Liverpool games, and paid particular attention to them. I mean, how big is that gulf between Rangers and Liverpool?
Oh, it was huge. It really was huge. The first game, you know, they barely got into the final third. The second game at Ibrox, I expected them to come out of the blocks quick because I think looking at the fixtures when they got the draw, I think they'd have looked at that one and saying that's the one that we really want to, you know, show ourselves for what we can do. Like you say, they got to a Europa League final last season, came to within a penalty shootout of winning that trophy. You know, so there was clearly some kind of substance there, but I don't know, it's almost like they've gone a little bit rabbit in the headlights. I think maybe we played them at the right time as well to have the two middle games when they've already had a little bit of the joy sucked out of them in the first two games. But yeah, you know, they did play quite well in the first half of the second game. But that second half was just, you know, one-way traffic. It was, you know, a 32-minute eye of the storm that I think not many clubs would have been able to combat, I think. But it was, yeah, a chasing an experience for them. But yeah, that gulf is quite pronounced. You know, I think, I don't know, to see any Scottish side prosper or to travel a distance in the Champions League, I don't know. I think there's going to have to be, you know, some kind of fundamental change. I remember years back they were talking about an Atlantic League. You know, that they wanted in on, you know, the English football pyramid. You know, at one point, I think you know whether those ships have completely sailed now. You know, you can never say never. But at the same time, you know, at what price would come with that? You know, it's again that landscape of football. You know, how much do you want to redraw it? You know, to be able to bring them into play.
I think as well, you know, they say, oh well, they come from a poor league, and you know, there's not enough competition and all of that.
My example there is Club Bruges. You know, the Belgian club football isn't in a particularly brilliant state. You know, Anderlecht have lost their manager to Burnley, a team that's been relegated from the Premier League into the Championship. You know, Burnley have been able to pick off the manager of Anderlecht. You know, this would be unthinkable, you know, in Anderlecht's pomp. You know, when they were winning, you know, the Cup Winners' Cup and reaching three successive finals, back-to-back UEFA Cup finals in the 1980s, another Cup Winners' Cup final as recently, although I say recently, it's 32 years ago now, 1990. You know, but this Anderlecht team of huge substance, but they've lost a manager to a relegated team in English football. You know, but I think it just illuminates how, well, what achievement Club Bruges have done, you know, so far this season in the Champions League. I'm delighted to see them doing what they're doing. And that's the type of example that Rangers and Celtic need to look towards and say, look, you know, I think football at the minute is great in respects to teams are looking at, you know, a club can look at an alternative club from a different country and say, look, we want to do what they've done. A lot of teams will look at, say, Atletico Madrid over the last few years and say, can we do something like them? Now, is there a club in English football that could do something like them? You know, is there a Scottish club that can turn around and say, you know, we can take an example of just what Club Bruges have done this season and try and implement our version of that, you know, moving forward? You know, they're the type of examples. You know, you've got to look at what you can do, what you're capable of. I mean, AC Milan last season won the league title in Italy. This is sounds higher up the pecking order, but Italian football's gone into something of a decay in the last couple of decades. But their success has been, that's kind of sprung from, they actually approached Liverpool and said, look, how have you been doing this in the last few years? You know, and they've looked at Liverpool and thought, can we implement something that's similar to what Liverpool have done, but put our spin on it? You know, and you know, a lot of clubs would look at someone like Atalanta, and you know, there's so many inspirational clubs. Borussia Mönchengladbach a few years ago, you know, had a really good system on the go. You know, you could look at any sort of, like, Union Berlin, you know, a classic example, Freiburg, you know, where have they come from? You know, it can be done, but, you know, the great killer for Scottish club football is that competitiveness and being given a regular game on a week-to-week basis. And I think that's one of the biggest sticking points that, I don't know, I think it's impossible to get over.
I think as well, I mean, you look, you know, you mentioned there, Dave, about those Scottish results. I mean, I watched Dundee United's first leg against AZ Alkmaar, where they beat them at Tannadice. The atmosphere was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have predicted the way they collapsed in the second leg like that. I remember thinking, Tanda, there's a few things going on in my head here. I'm saying about Rangers as well. I mean, look, last season, was it Sheriff Tiraspol won at Real Madrid? So surely if they can win at the Bernabeu, it's not beyond the ken of a Scottish team to go and get at least one-off results at the group stage to lift spirits, you know, to add a bit of hope to the team. I think as well, I mean, for looking, obviously, you know what Scottish football must have think, Dave, but from an outside perspective, one, I think the quality of manager in the Scottish League is woeful. I'll give two examples here. Well, you've got Derek McInnes, who was Aberdeen manager up to what quite recently, wasn't he, Dave?
Yeah, about 18 months.
But he was in charge of Bristol City in England and did nothing with them, got sacked by Bristol City. So you go from a middle-ranking championship club to taking over one of the top Scottish teams. You've got Jack Ross, who failed abysmally at Sunderland when they were in League One, who gets promoted from that job to taking over Dundee United. So straight away, you've got two long-standing, the new firm, in fact, you know, managed by by coaches who failed in England. I remember watching, well, 5 years ago, I went to Edinburgh for the weekend and I went to watch Hearts play Partick Thistle. And I saw the subs warming up and I checked my programme. And one of the subs for Hearts in the Scottish Premier League was Cole Stockton, who they just bought from Tranmere Rovers, who were then in the National League. And he was going to get a game in the Scottish Premier League. Livingstone now, their goalkeeper is ex-Liverpool, Shamal George, whose last club was Colchester United, who finished like third from bottom in League Two. So he's gone from the bottom of League Two to playing for Livingstone in the top flight of Scottish football. So I think there's an issue, A, of recruitment, and B, of managers, the ability and level of them in the Scottish Premiership as well. And you mentioned, Steve, about clubs to follow the example of. Yeah, you look at Celtic and Rangers and think, where are the young academy players here? Where are the players who come through with the DNA of the club? Where are the young prospects? Why are they not being given a route through to the first team? Because I think increasingly for the likes of Celtic, Rangers, Aberdeen, you know, any of the top Scottish clubs, bringing through youth products has to be the way forward for them. And, you know, and also good recruitment, buying young prospects and then selling them on. What, you know, once a fee comes in, you can't turn down. But given the pedigree of Scottish football in Europe over the years, you know, back to the 60s and 70s, Celtic, the first British club to win the European Cup, Rangers won the Cup Winners' Cup, Aberdeen won the Cup Winners' Cup, Dundee United got to a final of the Europa League. There's a pedigree there that other countries haven't got. And it just bewilders me the way the Scottish football, in terms of, you know, having been able to get results in Europe, I just kind of lost the knack of doing so. Because, I mean, when you watch the Rangers or Celtic games, the European games live on TV, the atmosphere crowds out the TV set. It makes you want to be there, even though you might have no affection for either club. And you think, what an intimidating atmosphere. Give the fans something to build on. Now, you saw in the Europa League last season, that really worked for Rangers, because I think the home support got them over the line quite a few games. But for some reason this season, it just hasn't happened to the same extent. Maybe the supporters didn't believe, I don't know. Maybe the fans didn't believe. But I think Scottish football needs some sort of recess. And it kind of, you know, brings this debate, doesn't it? There's come up a few times. One thing I was always hoping was that if the ESL had happened, if those clubs left the English system, I'd have happily invited Rangers and Celtic to join a reformed English Premier League and to see how that might have worked out as offering something different. Because you do wonder, you know, I don't know what your view would be, Dave, but Celtic and Rangers, are they Premier League material? Are they Championship material?
I think they would both be bottom six, top six. Bottom six Premier League, top six. Up Celtic a bit higher than that. I mean, I take all the points that you've made. I think one of the big problems in Scottish football, it's not a question so much of recruitment, it's a question of money. You know, they're taking players from Colchester and Tranmere and wherever, because that's the level of the finances that most of the clubs have got. And obviously, the TV deal up there is not as lucrative. And also, okay, you get 50, 60,000 people at Ibrox and Celtic Park every couple of games, but they keep the money. You know, even when Celtic turn up, if you're at, I don't know, St Mirren, you're probably getting 12,000 people in the ground or something. You're not making that much money. You're not being able to compete on that level. I think one of the other things that's really struck me this year in terms of the Champions League stuff from Celtic's perspective is, you mentioned Derek McInnes had been at Aberdeen. And what Derek did at Aberdeen was he was pragmatic. And over the six, seven seasons that he had at Aberdeen, they won a League Cup and they were never out of Europe. They qualified for Europe every year. And it wasn't always to the fans' taste, particularly towards the end, and eventually that expired and so on. But I think Celtic, because of the nature of Scottish football, the way that they win five and sixes every week, the kind of football that's demanded of them by their support, understandably, they have to be a swashbuckling kind of a side. When they go into Europe, they should be getting better results than they're getting, but they haven't got that pragmatic streak to them. They're probably too open. They don't defend well enough. Now, you know, you could argue that in Scotland they don't have to defend well enough because the other teams aren't getting at them enough. But they've got, you know, they've got international players there. They've got experienced players there. They should be doing a bit better than they're doing. And I think there's probably an unwillingness there, maybe because it's part of the DNA of the football club. But there's an unwillingness to be as pragmatic as they need to be to get some results against, you know. I mean, you look at their group, okay, Real Madrid, fair enough. But they've got Red Bull Leipzig and they've got Shakhtar Donetsk in there. Now, I'm not saying that that's an easy draw by any stretch of the imagination, but in Champions League terms, it's decent. It's, you know, it gives you a grain of hope, doesn't it? And you would think that, that somewhere there along the line, they could have ground something out a bit better than what they've got. But I think the nature of the way that they play is they're too attacking. You know, they have to take the game, try to take the game to players, to opposition teams rather. And in Europe, they find that that's not quite as easy as doing it at Motherwell.
Yeah, completely get all of the points there. You know, it's just such a impossible job, I think, for Scottish football to be able to bridge that gap. For Celtic, who probably be the best positioned out of the two Glasgow sides to put a decent tilt on a go of a Champions League group, especially when you, as you say, the group that they were blessed with this year, you know, it gives them that degree of hope to be able to progress. You know, what's the answer for them? Is it, you know, approaching a season and saying that, you know, Champions League football and how they do in the Champions League is the priority, and almost to kind of take their eye off the ball in the league, and to be able to say, look, we're going to have to try and play this style of football that is going to work for Europe, and maybe even test that out in some of the games that they play in the Scottish League, especially when, you know, you could maybe play that type of game when you go and play Rangers four times a season. You could try it out when you go to, you know, either the Edinburgh clubs or if you go to Aberdeen. You know, it's to be able to play that style of football more often is perhaps key to it, rather than saying, well, look, you know, we've got to go out and play the swashbuckler. But within that, you know, it's satisfying that need of the supporters to see that, you know, great flowing style of football. You know, whether they could do that, you know, to take that pragmatic approach into some of the league games, but also explain to the fans that this is why we're doing it. Because, you know, we want a decent crack at the Champions League and we need to learn how to be able to play that way. You know, it's so difficult for them to do. What the answer is, God knows.
I think as well, you know, the, you can explain things till you're blue in the face, but if Celtic lose to Rangers, it's the end of the world. And Rangers lose to Celtic, it's the end of the world. So, you know, there's always that dynamic going on in the background as well.
Totally, totally. Well, moving on to our collection of things we're looking forward to. I'm keeping things Scottish, though. We're moving to Paul's selection here.
Yeah, well, people may or may not be aware of this, but this weekend it's the second round of the Scottish FA Cup. Now, I'm a massive lover of cup football. I think I referred to the first round of the English FA Cup when I was on this programme 2 weeks ago. And to me, this is the most romantic cup competition in the UK by an absolute mile in terms of the teams that are involved and also the history and the background to it as well. So if it just take, you know, a bit of a snapshot of some of the games that are coming up, and if you ever see any clips of these games on Twitter, on social media, some of these grounds are in the most picturesque locations imaginable. Location right against the banks of the North Sea or in the middle of a huge forest with no civilization anywhere near for miles. There are just some brilliant locations. So, I mean, one of the games is Dunne Pace against Banks OD. Now, Banks OD, what a fantastic name, but also, that's kind of credit to the way the Scottish Pyramid non-league system has really improved over the last few years, because Banks OD are now actually in the Highland League, having got promoted from, I think it was the North Caledonian League, and they took the place of Fort William, who were like the perennial strugglers who finished bottom year after year after year and kind of survived on the novice of being Britain's worst team. So it's actually good that for once there's a system in place now where failure isn't rewarded consistently by media coverage and an opportunity being created, you know, for a team to move forward. You've also got Newtown Grange Star playing Hill of Beath fantastic. I just love the names of both of those two clubs there as well. You got Fraserburgh playing Stranraer from League Two. Have you ever seen pictures of Fraserburgh's ground? It's got this massive church right behind the terracing. The North Sea is just behind the church. And I think in a book that came out last year, the best 100 British grounds, it's in the top 10. It's such a picturesque, fantastic ground to see. And then you've got the romantically named Lithlingrow Rose. I mean, that's just a fantastic name. And they're playing the Spartans. It's like a clash of the Roman gladiators against a Caledonian outfit. And also, you've got in the Scottish Cup, something happened in the English Cup about 15 years ago. You've got two university teams playing in it. You've got Glasgow University and Stirling University. Now, I remember about 15 years ago, there was a club called Team Bath that were linked to Bath University that made it through to the first round proper of the FA Cup. And it just set me wondering, is there a reason why English university teams don't participate in the FA Cup? Because it's obviously quite a thing in the Scottish League. And both of those two teams are in the Scottish pyramid system as well. So there's just a whole wealth of interesting games and ties there. And I think as well, you kind of look, the way last season in the Scottish Cup, I think it was in the third round, Kelty Hearts, who were then a non-league team in the lower league, beat the current Scottish FA Cup holder, St Johnstone, 1-0. Now, that's like on a par with Coventry losing to Sutton United back in the 80s. But you just wouldn't get that type of result in an English FA Cup competition. Now, a team that's not in the league system, knocking out the FA Cup holders, absolutely fantastic. And it gives hope, doesn't it? Because some of these towns have populations of in the really low thousands, sometimes even less than that, but they maintain a football club. They kept it going despite all the, because the Highland League, every time you check it in the winter, it's postponed, so they have to get the fixtures back going again. So to play in those conditions and keep the clubs going, they must be like the most loyal supporters in the UK. I also think as well that Scottish clubs, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Dave, take the FA Cup there far more seriously than their English counterparts do. So they won't routinely put up a team of academy players and best star players, because it's, St Johnstone won it 2 years ago. You need to win about 4 or 5 games to be guaranteed a place in Europe if you can get to the Scottish FA Cup final. So there's a reason there why you want to play your strongest team as well. So I just find it's such a romantic competition. I always look out for the scores. And if I can track down footage on social media, I always watch it. And I think from the next round onwards, you'll get BBC Alba does the highlights as well. And whether you understand Scottish Gaelic or not doesn't really matter. You can just follow the flow of the conversation, listen to it. But it's a football romantic's dream, and it has a level of interest for me that's way beyond anything that can be offered this side of the border.
Totally agree with that, Paul. I mean, it spoiled the team that won the English FA Cup last season, but, apart from watching that, I can't remember the last time I'd watched an English FA Cup final, simply because of it being the rank and file and the same usual suspects, battling it out. And it's not just a case of like the early rounds. I mean, some of the names of those teams that you've rattled off there are just absolutely outstanding. Sound like they're from a comic book somewhere from the 1960s or 1970s. They're found in the loft somewhere. someone called Billy is going to have some magic boots in one of those games. Yes, I'm absolutely positive of it. But it's kind of like at the business end of the competition as well. Yeah, Celtic won like 4 on the spin, for a few years. But there's always that feeling that, any team can win. In the last 15 years alone, St Johnstone have won it twice. Hibs finally cracked the code. The wonderful scenes of them singing Sunshine on Leith at Hampden. Hearts have won it. Dundee United won it. Inverness Caledonian Thistle. But some of the teams who made the final and never... Motherwell, got in there again. Falkirk, Ross County, even Queen of the South. Within the last 15 years, Queen of the South and Dunfermline. Yeah, Gretna got there as well. It does have that. Yes, there's a good chance that Celtic and Rangers will meet in the final, or yes, there's a really good chance that Celtic or Rangers are going to win it. But there's a really good chance that they won't. You know, there's a really good chance that they've been drawn together in the round four, and whoever, you know, whichever one of them progresses, might just trip up at the next round. And it's always not light. I mean, I always remember going back to the early 1990s and watching Motherwell win it against Dundee United. I always had a soft spot for Dundee United in the 80s. Just had the coolest kit, and every time on Football Focus, it always seemed to be Eamon Bannon and Paul Sturrock scoring screamers. And you know, I just always looked out for them for the results, and you know, they obviously got to that UEFA Cup final in 87, and should have got to the European Cup final in 84. So yeah, that new firm, you know, that broke the cartel and all of that. But yeah, you know, St Mirren winning in 87. I remember St Mirren winning in 87. So while those were victories against kind of like the Scottish team that I had, you know, a bit of a soft spot for, you know, it was absolutely brilliant to see them do it, and to see these names get their moment, you know. And it was comparable at one point in time to English football. So when you were getting the Coventries and the Wimbledons winning the FA Cup, Watford getting to the final, Brighton getting to the final, as that's ebbed away in English football, it's continued to be the case in Scottish football, you know. And it's the same as well for the League Cup in Scotland, you know. And it's just brilliant to see it, because these clubs just have their chance, their shot at glory. There's no chance that they're going to win the league, you know, in the top division. Absolutely no chance whatsoever. But there is every chance that, you know, if you're any club and you've sat there and watched, you know, Inverness Caledonian Thistle lift the cup, then that, you know, it gives you that pedestal to aim for, that prize to shoot for, you know. Dream big and shoot for the stars in the cups.
Yeah, the Scottish Cup to me now seems like the FA Cup was when I was growing up in the 70s. It's still got that same feel to it. And right the way through the competition, you know, you do still have that romance and that excitement of the non-league teams coming in and the possibility that they might do something. We talk about the weather being the great leveller in the FA Cup in the third round in the olden days when it was mud up to your thighs and all. Well, it still is in some of the pitches in Scotland. Because if you're playing in a Scottish Cup tie in December, January, the chances are it's snowing. So, you know, there's a bit of a leveller there for a start-off. But you're dead right that they do take the competition seriously. You know, I mean, I remember 2-3 years ago, Aberdeen played a game on the, I think it was the Wednesday night. They got a cup tie on the Saturday and they rested players from the league game to make sure they were fit for the Saturday, for the cup tie, which, you know, you would never see in the Premier League. It would always be the other way around. And from an English perspective, I've never understood that. If you're relatively safe in the Premier League come the back end of January, you know, if you've got 30-odd points at that point, you're not going to go down. I've never understood why they still persist in leaving players out for an FA Cup tie, because they've got, you know, they've got to play Fulham away on the Wednesday night or something. I absolutely don't understand it. You know, I know the points for the money you get for places up the league and all of that sort of stuff. But what the hell is the point of the game if you're not going to try and get to Wembley? If you're not going to try and win a cup? If you're not going to try and get some glory? What are we doing it for? And in Scotland, there's still that element of it. You know, there's still that absolute obsession we get into Hampden Park playing in the cup final. And, you know, every now and again, as you say, St Johnstone did the cup double a couple of seasons ago. It isn't always Celtic and Rangers. You know, there is lots and lots of times where the other team wins or they don't even both get to the final, good God. You know, and that, I think, is, that's got all the ingredients of what makes cup football the best kind of football, and which, you know, sadly in England we've lost completely, I think.
Oh, completely, completely. Moving on, I'll go for my topic next, looking forward to it. I'm just totally besotted with Serie A football again. You know, I turned away from it during Juventus's, you know, reign of, you know, was it 9 on the run, was it, that they won? I think any league that has that level of domination, I'm always going to switch off from. So, you know, I was estranged from the Serie A for a good few years. But, you know, Inter, like, breaking that monopoly of Juventus was brilliant 2 seasons ago. You know, AC Milan winning it last season was another step in the right direction. It was brilliant. But the first opening kind of like salvo of this season's Serie A is just even better. You know, it's been wonderful to see Napoli do so well. You know, they've threatened over the last few years, and then there's been some kind of injury crisis at some point and the wheels have fell off. But they seriously look like the real deal this season thus far. But they aren't alone there. The two Roman clubs have done so well. Udinese have started well. It's been utterly brilliant to see the top end of that Serie A populated by teams that haven't won Serie A for a very long time, or in the case of two of them, Udinese and Atalanta, never having won it. It's got to a point that next weekend, Atalanta and Lazio go head-to-head in a very attractive-looking game that has a great huge burden on the top of the division. There's only 3 points splitting them. You know, Atalanta have been top. You know, it looks like Milan are going to win their game tonight. You know, so it's all very, very close. But suddenly you've got these games that are absolutely massive, and they're not involving, you know, any of the, you know, that big, huge, successful triumvirate of the clubs of Juventus and the two Milan clubs. You know, Udinese for the last 2 weekends, you know, they've got drawn with Lazio this weekend, and I think they got a draw with Atalanta last weekend. You know, it is just so refreshing to see this. You know, next week when it's going to be Lazio up against Atalanta in Bergamo, it's, you know, Gasperini versus Sarri as well. You know, it's these two very expansive thinking, you know, football thinking individuals that are puppeteering these two excellent football clubs that, you know, in with an half decent shout of being there when the prizes are handed out at the end of the season.
Yeah, I'd agree, Steve. I mean, it's good the way Serie A has become competitive again, because, as I said, there's nothing worse than just the same team winning the title every season, is there? So, it just deadens any further interest you have in the competition at that level. And just like glancing at Serie A now, I mean, I think you've got like there's there's five points separating the top of the table, Napoli, from Udinese in fifth place. And I say Udinese have never won the title before as well. Atlanta never won the title before. It's also good as well that the geographical divides kind of moved away a little bit as well. So you've gone from a position where it's always the northern half of Italy who dominate the league table. So you've got the Napoli at the top, you've got Roma just outside top 4 to 5 as well. And, you know, Udinese, that's, you know, never had a strong footballing history, put themselves in contention as well. And I think that it's kind of had a knock-on effect with the performance of Italian teams in Europe as well, that maybe they're benefiting from, you know, we mentioned about Scotland before, the league not being competitive. Maybe Serie A has benefited in Europe in our last one or two seasons because it's a far, far, far more competitive league. And I don't know what you think, Steve, but do you think the coverage of BT of Serie A when they're showing 4 or 5 games a weekend, do you think that's kind of helped to engender the greater interest in this again?
I think it does. You know, they have a lot of enthusiasm for it, and that's what you need. Is if a broadcaster, you look at Sky and they're somewhat, I don't know, afterthought of showing the Bundesliga at the minute, which is a huge shame, because this season's Bundesliga has started off magnificently. You know, Bayern Munich are not having it their own way, and Sky could make so much more out of what's happening in Bundesliga at the minute. But BT really go for it. They show, you know, the only games they don't show live are the ones that are part of the blackout, part of the day on a Saturday afternoon. So yeah, there is the fact that they have James Richardson kind of like fronting the programme. You know, you're always going to be drawn in by the fact that it's James Richardson involved, and you know, and a kind of, you know, friend of the podcast does the commentaries on a Sunday night, yeah, in Adam Summerson. You know, so yeah, you know, I think it's got all the aesthetics, but the fact that, you know, I'm really kind of enjoying it this season more than the last two seasons, is the fact that, you know, sadly, in that way that football does have these monopolies, no team other than, you know, Juventus or even the Milan clubs have won Serie A since, what, 2001, when Roma last won it. You know, no team away from Turin, Milan or Rome has won the title since Sampdoria did it in 91. So 30 years we're going back from the Serie A title being won by a club from one of the biggest power bases in Italy. And I think that's just why I'm just enjoying seeing, you know, Napoli, Udinese, Atalanta up there, and and really threatening to do it this time, you know, and nothing against the Milan clubs. And, you know, if Juventus have any kind of, you know, goodwill in them, they shouldn't win the Serie A for 9 years, basically, after winning it for 9 successive years at the very least. You know, I'd be more than happy to see, you know, either the Milan clubs win it, but I'd be even happier if someone can break that cartel. You know, we want another Sampdoria, we want another Verona, you know, a Napoli from when they were all winning it in the 80s and the early 90s. And and for me, it just looks like, you know, this season is threatening to be that season.
I'm really pleased for Sarri that he's back up there, because I think he had a pretty raw deal at Chelsea, in particular Juventus, after winning the title and being got rid of. So it's nice to see him doing well. But I mean, the amazing thing is it's three or four teams that are up there, and you might normally.
It's not just one, is it? That's the big thing this season so far. It's that collective of them have all come.
What is it that's caused it? You know, you would often get one team, Leicester City or whatever, an outlier coming from somewhere. But to have such a concentration of them is bizarre.
It is. Again, I mean, whether it comes down to, you know, we were talking about the need for some clubs to look for some kind of inspiration from what other clubs have done. You know, maybe the Udinese's and the Lazio's are looking at what Atalanta have done, and, you know, a relatively modest football club, and saying, well, look, if they can do it, why can't we pull ourselves together? You know, Lazio have a proud history about themselves. They've won a couple of Scudettos. You know, they've reached European finals. You know, they should do infinitely better than they have periodically done, certainly over the last, you know, they're never going to be the Lazio of the Cragnotti era, where they were breaking world record transfer fees and all that. It's a different era now in Italy. But, you know, I think teams are much more, clubs are much more organised now. You know, and I think as well, you're looking at someone like Juventus, they've reached and overarched in trying to compete in the Champions League, and signed the likes of Cristiano Ronaldo, and they've gone for the short burst. There's a little bit of about Juventus for me in what Manchester United were like in the final years of Alex Ferguson. They've kind of gone for the quick fix signing. You know, always hark back to Robin van Persie. You know, he was always only going to be a short-term option, but it was like he was shooting for that one last Champions League success that never quite came. And Juventus have fallen into that trap. And I always remember Real Madrid doing it in the early 90s as well. They had a spate of European Cup semi-finals, and they took their eye off the ball domestically, and through came Barcelona and won 4 on the spin. And, you know, Real Madrid fell away somewhat domestically by their high standards. And I think Juventus are kind of going through that themselves at the minute. And the fact that, like, Inter won the title but then lost Conte, you know, and in came Inzaghi, it brings a different pressure. And now you've got Milan, who've started the defence of their title very well, but, you know, defending a title is a completely different matter to winning it in the first place. It's a very difficult thing to do. So I think there's a lot of variables for each of those three megaliths of the Italian game that it's suddenly offered a little bit of Scottish Cup-type hope to the rest of the members of the Serie A fraternity.
You just hope one of them follows through on it and wins the title in the end.
Oh, it would be magnificent if they do. It would be magnificent. And again, if that was to happen, you know, does it open the door for other clubs to do likewise? Could only say fingers crossed in that respect. For our last topic, Dave, you're going to bring us full circle. Basically, it's back to the EFL.
It is. I mean, the EFL now are calling for the end of the embargo on live football being screened on television or streaming on a Saturday afternoon, 2:45 to 5:15, which was always the old thing. I think Bob Lord of Burnley was one of the great architects of that, in his terror of what television was going to do to attendances back in the day in the mid-60s. The threat obviously always was to attendances. Most games take place at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, even now, in this post-Sky era. But it's become very difficult to enforce it, I think, in the digital world now. I mean, if you look at Twitter or any of the social media things on any Saturday afternoon, you'll find loads and loads of posts on there pointing you to this illegal stream to watch that game. And you'll read people who are talking about a game that they're obviously watching in the local pub on some dodgy stream from somewhere or other. You know, you can have a virtual private network so you can plug into, you know, Swedish servers and get the games that are being shown over there at 3 o'clock and all of that. So, I mean, it does feel like a rule that's from a different age now. I mean, it does feel like one that probably needs to go. And obviously from the point of view of the EFL, if teams can stream their game on a Saturday at 3 o'clock to their website, they're going to make some money from it, which is the big driver. They don't want it being sent out for free on some dodgy stream. They want to get their hands on the cash. You know you can understand that. They bought it in for midweek games in the 18-19 season before COVID, and there was a little drop off in attendances for midweek games at that point, but nothing majorly significant. So I suppose Saturday was always the next sort of frontier for that. And it, you know, you can kind of see why they're doing it, particularly with the Sky deal coming up in 18 months that ends in 23-24. So they'll be looking at what they can do in the future for that. I think from an EFL perspective, it makes pretty much perfect sense. I think it's very difficult to argue against it in the modern world. Instinctively, I don't like it because I'm from that, not the modern world, but I think that there's a compelling logic to it. I think there are dangers to it though. I think first of all, it's the thin end of the wedge for the Premier League to jump in and start showing games at any time that they like in this country. And I think that would be a bit more dangerous. If you were having a game like today, Liverpool, Man City, at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, I think that would do a fair bit to attendances. And I think the other thing is where you are going to lose fans, I think, is the away fans. You know, if you've got a long trek from Plymouth to Derby on a freezing cold January, you might think again. You might think, oh, well, for a tenner, I can watch it on the stream on the club website. And without away fans, as we were talking about earlier, you know, when the away fans aren't there, the atmosphere is not there either. And I think that makes a difference. That's one of the big dangers of this. But it just feels to me like just one of those irresistible forces that's coming along. And I can't see how they vote against it, knowing that, you know, there are so many illegal ways of watching the game for free. I'm sure that they'll just want to take their slice of the pie now.
I agree, Dave. I mean, I'm like you. The romantic in me thinks keep it, but in the social media age, you just can't do that. There's so many ways around of accessing games at 3 o'clock on Saturday that, you know, it's almost like as ineffective as the dog license, isn't it? You know, it's something that you should have, but nobody actually gets prosecuted for not having. So to me, it just seems like it looked like it's not a practical solution in the modern game. So I think, you know, you have to go along with that. And going back to your point about fans, well, it's quite interesting this, I think, because I live near my local non-league team, Marina. It's about 5 minutes walk from my house. And, you know, sometimes when the Champions League games are, I'll go and watch Marina, and I come and say, why are you watching Real Madrid against Napoli on the Champions League? And why watching Marina? Because I prefer my football. I don't care how good the TV race is. I've not got any interest in getting my kicks from football from watching live TV. I'd rather be there at the ground. And I'm sure, you know, the majority of fans of non-league clubs and English Football League clubs, but, you know, even if there was a huge counter-attraction, I can still, maybe 70-75% would still go to watch their local team, even if there was a counter-attraction TV-wise as well. I think also as well, there will come a point when there's such saturation coverage of Premier League games. Like for example, I had the choice of staying at home and watching Brighton against Brentford, or I saw Tranmere playing at home. I thought, I'll go and watch Tranmere instead in their game. So, you know, we go to watch Tranmere. It's a far more entertaining game than what I would have had watching Brighton against Brentford on the TV. So I think for a genuine football fan, I think you won't be deterred from going to watch a match you want to go to because there's counter tracks on TV. The only way it would affect me would be if Marine were playing on a Saturday afternoon and an Everton away game was on live at 3 o'clock, I'd watch the Everton away game. But apart from that circumstance, I don't have it impinge upon me directly.
Yeah, it needs a happy medium. I mean, I think it's mad that you can have a season ticket for a football club, but you don't have access to kind of like every game in a way, at least, you know, if either clicking through a turnstile or watching it on the television. I think if you pay nearly £1,000 for a season ticket, it should buy you some kind of right to be able to watch every game unfold. You know, so I don't know, maybe in a way of buying a streaming season ticket, basically, you know, would be a way of doing it, rather than just picking off floating viewers and saying, here's a game, we're streaming it, you can pay a fiver for it. You know, if you buy into it for the start of the season, then, you know, you've bought your online season ticket, basically, you know, because like Paul said, you know, if Marina at home, but Everton were on the telly at 3 o'clock, he'd be watching Everton, and I'd be the same with Liverpool. You know, I'd go and watch a live game that's nearby. But, you know, if my team's on the television, then I'd sit and watch that instead. But I wouldn't sit at home and watch anyone else's game. You know, I think there is that much saturation in football already. But I think, you know, there has to be a cleverer way of thinking about it. Yes, I think the 3 o'clock embargo is a draconian one now. But I think within that as well, you know, trial it for a season. No, then that's the acid test. Trial it for a season, and if you find that there's a drop off in support in you know, local games, then simply revert to what it was in the past. You know, I think unless it's tried, it'll never be known. It'll just be feared.
I think that's the one element of it that does appeal to me is it's kind of the anti 1983 digital revolution. I mean, for me, the beginning of the end was 1983 when we stopped sharing the gate money at league games, and the home team kept all the money, and that was the original sin that led to the Premier League and all of that. And I mean, I suppose this way, it's a way of the away team getting some money. You know, if you sell 250 passes on your website to the game that you're playing away from home, and you get, I don't know, 10 quid a throw, you know, you're bringing in £2,500 for a game that you would otherwise get no money for. That quite appeals to me in a quirky kind of a way. But I think that the danger is, you know, you're dead right about whether it would impact probably on the lower local teams, the non-league teams and that kind of stuff. I don't think there'd be any interest from the EFL. If it worked for them, they couldn't give a stuff whether Marine have lost 250 supporters, because their stream thing is doing well. And I think that's a danger to it. I think, you know, If the EFL teams all see an uptick in their revenue, that's all they want to know. They'll keep it. I think going back to you know, where we started, the one thing that the EFL has got is a great product. I think the Championship, I think League One and League Two are all really terrific leagues in their own way. You know, you're not talking about Champions League quality football, but you are talking about some exciting football, great games, you know, all sorts of incidents and that kind of stuff. I think where the EFL is really poor is in marketing what they've got. I think they should do a much better job of that. And I think that, you know, they probably deserve much better money from whichever TV deal it is that they're getting. And I suppose this is an attempt to move in that direction, because I suppose you might be able to sell this to Amazon, or you might be able to sell it to Netflix or whichever other streaming service you can think of.
No, completely. You know, I think they'll always look for some kind of avenue. I mean, Wrexham, a point in case there is that, you know, the Hollywood owners have been trying to push for, you know, global streaming of the games, and they can't understand why, you know, they wouldn't want, you know, the league wouldn't want that to happen for greater exposure. You know, it always comes down to that need for balance, you know, and that fear of change. But within that, like I said, you know, unless you try it, you'll never know. You know, it'll always be, you know, a case of, you know, the worst case scenario will be, you know, projected until proved wrong.
No, I would agree with that. I think that it's got to be worth a try for a season just to see where it all ends up in the end.
Yeah, I agree. Totally agree.
Completely. Well, that's been a brilliant hour and a half, or close on an hour and a half. As surreal as it's been to be at the wheel, it's actually been quite therapeutic. I've enjoyed that. And it's been a wonderful podcast. Thanks, Dave.
Pleasure. I'll go away and edit it now.
And there you go, Ryan edits it. Now he gets
a
double shift.
Not a word about the other.
He gets a double shift tonight. And Paul, thank you so much as well for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Steve. And thanks to you for your consummate hosting of the show this evening as well. And it's fantastic, isn't it, to be in a podcast where in the space of 90 minutes we cover every angle of football from Lazio to Lithen-Glovos. Absolutely superb. Thank you.
It is. We've taken in the Highlands and everywhere.
It has been
a wonderful.
It's a scenic journey around the world of football.
Well, whoever takes us in what directions next week, we're not sure of yet. Well, those seats are still to be filled. But yeah, I'm sure whoever's on next week will take us in all sorts of different directions as well. Thank you for listening as well, whoever's out there. And yes, thanks again. This is the Lob Podcast from These Football Times. And we'll see you again very soon.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.